Welcome to Awakening Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Seema, and I will be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you, everyone, for joining us. Today, our special guest is none other than Howard Glasser, and someone who really embodies today's theme of transforming the difficult child. Since we have the pleasure of a remarkable moderator, Nithika, today, I thought we could start by asking her to kick off our circle.
Howard, I am so glad to have you here amongst us. There are so many ways to introduce you, to talk about your work. Howard has been called one of the most influential living persons working to reduce children's reliance on psychiatric medications. He is the author of Transforming the Difficult Child, top-selling author, Nurturing Up, Nurtured Heart Approach, the new Inner Wealth Initiative. He is chairman of the Board of Children's Success Foundation. So many things professionally, but particularly the way I'd like, at least for our service space community, what strikes me about Howard is a very listening and compassionate person who has worked through his difficult experience as a child. But beyond that, he has tapped into his gift, and he's offering this gift and service to people who are going through a similar challenge. So Howard, would you like to share your moment, as Seema so nicely introduced us to the theme, is your moment when you talk about your difficult childhood. And I read somewhere that it almost took you to death's door. I'd like to hear.
It almost took me to death's door 100 times over. So rather than one incident, maybe it's best to put it this way. I believe I had loving parents who didn't quite know how to see me and connect with me or light up the runways they wanted to light up. Looking back, I could say that it was such that I formed an energetic impression. I watched my world, and even though they were urging me to be respectful and do the right thing and be responsible, when I was respectful and kind and all the things they wanted me to do, I barely received any of the connection and relationship I was craving when I wasn't doing the things that they so cared about. They would wind up leaning in, all excited, all animated, spending time with me. And I think my situation is very typical of kids who have a little more neediness, a little more intensity, a little more sensitivity, which are all wonderful qualities, but that in combination puts children in a position of craving relationship. And some kids just simply discover that they get so much more when things are going wrong rather than when things are going right. And it becomes part of their nature. And, I believe in the process, they pay a big price of forgetting who they really are as someone with greatness, with wonderful things to contribute. It's very easy for a child to start believing in lesser And I think that was very much the case for me. I think there are a lot of kind, loving parents out there who struggle with their kids because they just by way of normal traditional approaches, they fall into a pattern of relationship with their children that concerns, distresses them, and kind of creates a disconnect with their children. So it's not fun for anybody when that's happening.
Yeah, I have observed a lot of the dynamics that you just talked about. And one sentence you said really made me pause, which is, in such a dynamic, children then tend to go towards behavior patterns where they get more in a lesser situation, which is less fulfilling. And it's kind of this this pattern of behavior that kind of sets in. And I'm thinking not only children, even adults. We have subtly over time, we get, addicted to those kinds of behavior patterns. And of course, the nurturing heart approach does address this. And before we quite get there, Howard, would you mind just talking about, that first instant when you realize this gift, that this is what I can offer the world?
It kind of snuck up on me. I'm not sure there was, I could remember the time I took it, like I really owned it and said, I just was very mad at somebody who wasn't giving credence to some accomplishments that were staring us in the face. And I just walked away in a very mad state, but I channeled that energy into a belief. This is 25 years ago where I went, I know more in my little finger than all the people who, all the scientists. Because at the time, the scientists, I think it's worth saying, all the people who believe in cerebral functioning and study neurology and neurological functioning, they could cite, hundreds if not thousands of research studies. And when you, at the end of the day, all their wisdom leads them to believing that it's a brain disorder and the only thing that helps is medication. And then you have all these other people who believe in brain chemistry and could cite thousands of articles. And at the end of the day, they believe it's a chemical imbalance in these children. And it distills down to medication A, B, C. So, and they don't get anywhere. You could, I'm on an ADHD Google alert, and I get these articles all the time that basically say it's getting worse, not better, and kids don't improve from medication. And I object to medications mostly because it sends kids the message that something's wrong with you because of your life force, your intensity. Right. We need to make it go away because you can't handle it and nobody else can. I don't think that's a good message we want to be sending our youth, because we all rely on our life force to, we wouldn't get out of bed in the morning without it. Mm-hmm. And your accomplishments, the great things you're doing in life, the things of service you're doing, all depend on your ability to engage and mobilize your life force. So I'm very concerned about that. I know I just steered the conversation a little differently, but that was when I really started owning, I have something unique to contribute, and it made me very, very determined to get out into the world and share as much as I can.
Mm-hmm. And it is so needed. You know, we do have a life force, as you so rightly captured, which helps us get up in the morning. And medicines, you know, I have family members who are in the business of understanding and working with the FDA. So I have somewhat of an exposure to, you know, how the meds get approved and all of it. But, you know, that aside, there are lots of side effects of a lot of these medications. And then down the road, you know, after a clinical trial, then you realize that, oh, you know, for a teenager to use this, it could lead them to be actually suicidal. So there's definitely a lot more that science hasn't caught up with. But let's return back to us tapping into our life force and your work in that. I'm just going to read, for those of us who are just joining us, we're talking to Howell Glasser, and I'm going to just read very quickly about the Nurtured Heart Approach from the website Children's Success Foundation. And it says, the Nurtured Heart Approach is a relationship-focused methodology founded strategically in the three stands for helping children and adults build their inner wealth and use their intensity in successful ways. It has become a powerful way of awakening the inherent greatness in all children while facilitating parenting and classroom success. Howard, would you tell us, I know you're in New Jersey right now, and you mentioned that you're talking to all the welfare organizations statewide to train the trainer on this approach. Could you share with us?
It's very exciting. My overarching goal these days is to train trainers who then go out and teach this. Excuse me. And by way of a few of those key people in New Jersey child welfare system, they decided to make it to stipulate. Excuse me. They decided to stipulate on a state level that Nurtured Heart Approach would be central to all facilities who work in the child welfare system, which means all agencies and organizations that deal directly with foster children, oftentimes the juvenile justice system. I'm sure it'll find its way to education, and especially kids in out-of-home placements and kids in group homes and residential treatment. And I just love the fact that I believe that this will lead to those very deserving children to be treated with more dignity and respect, and to see they too, you know, aren't the bad kid or even the good kid, but the great kid. And so I'm very excited. New Jersey coordinated system of care already gets quite a bit of worldwide attention because some of its prior accomplishments. And so this last week was a training for leaders in the first launch, a cluster of counties that will, over 4 years, will become all of New Jersey. And it was very exciting to see people who care deeply but may have had approaches that left them compromised and left them questioning, well, how in the world can we do this? And they were all prepared. They all had taken a one-day training and read some materials. But it was exciting to spend a week in a way transporting them into the heart of this and seeing for themselves, oh, my goodness, we really can do this. This approach is really going to let us light up runways for these kids and see the best in them, and for them to see the best in themselves. You know, they were very concerned I think what drove this is they were extremely concerned that as far as they had come, there was still a very high level of restraints. Mm-hmm. You know, when a child gets agitated and aggressive, mm-hmm. They have had a limited plan, and it led them into a corner oftentimes of taking a child down. And it was very often that kids would get hurt and staff would get hurt. And, you know, so this approach is really about leading kids to see they have self-restraint and they don't need restraints. But it's not like talking to them directly and saying, mm-hmm. oh, you can do it. You have, you don't need restraint. It's a matter of immersing them into a firsthand experience of saying, here you are being restrained. Here you are looking mad and looking like you're going to lash out, but you're not hitting and you're not cussing and swearing mm-hmm. and you're not doing all these not great things that you could be doing. So therefore, how great is it that you're using your power and using your wisdom to do what you're doing right now? And, you know, kids look at you in the beginning like you're, you know, from another planet, understandably. And, and it's exciting to see that over time they can drink this in. It's like planting seeds and watching seeds take root, you know, giving kids kind of the primal nutrition of us through these kinds of statements and nourishing them and leading them to their own inner wealth. In a way, you know, maybe there'll always be the disparity of 99%, less financially set and 1% who are the haves. But I really think all kids can be inner billionaires. That's mm-hmm. my mm-hmm. humble opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, right there with you. Right there with you on the children's potential and their inner wealth. I just want to read out the one-line message you had for the world, which we captured on our Awaken page, which is, children do not awaken from the fear of punishment. They awaken to their greatness. I just really loved how you captured that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's talk also about, how this kind of inner wealth, inner greatness, inner life force, how can it be used for creativity? I think children are really, really creative people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with, expectations and labels of being a difficult child or, any of those labels, innately, children are very, very creative. And how mm-hmm. could we tap into that life force for letting their creativity express themselves?
Well, there's two things that come to mind. One is that as a child who has this prior patterning comes to feel a new sense of successfulness as they come to experiencing what I'm calling inner wealth, I think a natural outcome of that is they begin to express themselves in all kinds of great ways. So, I, as a parent of a kid who grew up this way, I like to think kind of amusingly that, I'm probably as out of control or more out of control as a parent than a parent of a difficult child, because the kid who feels great is going to manifest mm-hmm. that everywhere they go. They're going to keep growing the edges of that. They're going to keep exploring what's possible. So, even though they're just going to keep changing. And so if I was attached to, one particular outcome as a parent, I'd be frustrated. Mm-hmm. So that's one thread. And the second thread is, if I were working in a program, like in education or in anything where I was teaching a creative endeavor, mm-hmm. I could absolutely choose to again and again see and appreciate and express my my appreciation for different aspects of creative endeavors. And make it my mission to say nuanced statements about, let's say it's a dance class and, instead of saying, oh, wow, what a beautiful dance, I would distill that down into the qualities of creativity that I see in this child or these children. And whether that's dedication or whether that's the actual word creativity or whether that's intuitiveness or ingenuity or different unique ways of putting two and two together or engaging different muscle groups or whatever it is, I'd want to lead my eyes to see, maybe see with my heart and put words to that. And I think that's what kids get excited about when they feel like, they are appreciated. And I believe that external version is what over time lends itself to their unique internal version of how they see themselves.
Ah, nice. I understand your daughter. She's a yoga instructor, and also she is also dabbling in small farms.
And she's an artist. She went to Rhode Island School of Design. She actually has taken a fancy to doing murals, and she just did for our friend Nemo Patel. She just did a mural for his Planting Seeds video.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so, Planting Seeds, hat tip to Nemo on his musical album. It's just wonderful to see these different strands naturally coming together. It's
mm-hmm.
beautiful. I also wanted to... let's talk a little bit about your woodworking. I'm curious, when you took that break in the middle of your graduate studies to do woodworking and how that kind of side journey informed your work.
A few ways. One is, I at, on the precipice of taking on a dissertation, being that I wasn't clear about what I wanted to do, and the ideas I was throwing out weren't getting any traction. I decided, okay, I'm going to take a break, and I had you have a 10-year period to come back and finish. I decided I was going to live my childhood dream, which was really a little preposterous because, I had no background or anything. It was just what I like to do is, a little tinkering. And that was woodworking. And I had kind of a fly-by-night idea of what I would do. But then being audacious a little bit, I opened up a little storefront on 3rd Avenue and 12th Street in New York City, and people would come in with projects that were way beyond my skill level, and there would always be some wonderful person who showed up who would help me, would want a job, and they were at least, a level or two beyond the projects that were coming my way. And eventually, there were projects coming my way that were really, high level New York fancy things. Mm. And, I got to work with some virtuoso woodworkers. I did learn to be a craftsman to some extent. But the fun thing that came out of it is, for a year we were doing this fancy showroom in Soho, and it involved a lot of curved laminate work. And to do those, you had to build the curves like a boat with struts, and you had to get them just perfect, because if they weren't perfect, the end product would look funny. And so after you build the struts, you had to put this curved, this very thin plywood on top, and then before you applied the laminate. And I hated to throw away, I hated waste, and I hated to throw away the leftovers of this curved, this plywood that was made for curving. So I wound up gluing them together and making these interesting curved sculptures. And eventually that became my fascination. And, you know, as it is now, I don't have a lot of time, but maybe once a year or so, I'll make a fun swirling curved sculpture. People always want to know, how did you do that? And I say, it's made out of wood, and no one can imagine how in the world that could be made out of wood. So I have a good time with that.
That's
about the long and short of my woodworking career.
That's great. I think, you know, to any kind of artistic endeavor that takes you and keeps you in touch with an element of nature, it just kind of, at least even for me, you know, even just a walk in nature, and it just is so fulfilling, and it just takes me in a different space in my mind, you know, where, like you say, it has to be just perfect or not, it can be what it can be. Just very, very free-flowing. So thank you so much for sharing that. Can you, I know that a lot of your work has also gone international. So sometimes a lot of our callers are calling in from different places. So maybe this is an opportunity to, you know, to share the far-reaching, you know, even through your books. I don't know, do you have a new book coming out right now, or any next new stages for Howard Glasser?
The last book that came out fairly recently was called Igniting Greatness. The subtitle is Remembering Who We Really Are. And it dovetails with something you said earlier, is the price paid for, excuse me, if I use myself as an example, you know, having grown up with that patterning of believing I get more to life through negativity, the formatting of that settles even after childhood is that's how I interacted with myself. You know, I wound up realizing that as much as I believed I was a positive person, when push came to shove, I was actually quite a negative person. When things went right, I would say some swift and swift and energetically vague statements like good job or way to go. When things went wrong, I would have these long perseverating conversations that swirled around the negativity. So at some point, maybe 15 years ago, I realized that I wanted to apply the same method that I apply to kids to myself. And I wanted to change my default setting. I wanted to change my energy. I wanted to be able to really see and appreciate myself deeply when it came to what wasn't wrong, what was right, and not get lost when something, you know, when there was a challenge. So that book describes my experience of feeling like I've accomplished enough in that regard. And now I have a book coming out on the horizon where I'm kind of a collaboration between somebody who's a master of collaborative play and who has become excited about Nurtured Heart Approach, and he's integrated this unique way of speaking to children while immersed in play, and it's very exciting. We've had about a dozen people experimenting with this model for the last year or two, and it's going to be fun to see if we can get it out there in the world.
That sounds very, very exciting. In a number of ways, at least for me, I love when you talk about changing the default settings. I think I do too. Have you know, a tendency to kind of focus on what's not working and the negativity, and just an ability, an innate ability to change that default setting to what is wonderful and what is wholesome and what is working and what is positive is a gift. You know, and when you say it's almost like coming full circle for you, where the work you're doing with the kids is also informing and helping you change your default setting personally. I think that's beautiful when all of this comes full circle. I'm wondering, you know, through this question, when a child is in a really, really dark place and has a sense of deep sense of hopelessness, how do you break through to a child like that?
When they're in a really dark place, and I missed the last part of that statement.
Feel a sense of hopelessness.
Oh, in a sense of hopelessness. I feel it's very much the same journey of working with a child with other kinds of acting out behaviors. And maybe it helps to see that as a subtle, almost undetectable form of acting out. Some kids, I believe, simply discover that by way of their symptoms of depression or symptoms of anxiety or despair, that's when people rally, and that's when people come to their rescue and spend time with them. So if I'm a child who craves relationship, and I'm not the acting out kind of child, but I just inadvertently discover that when I'm distressed or hopeless, to use your word, or despairing, that the significant adults in my life come and spend time with me. It might, in a similar way, be easy for me to form an impression, you know, an energetic, even though they're there trying to rally me and talk me into coming out and do, you know, come out and play, so to speak. Underneath that, you know, so they think they're talking to me in a reasonable, rational way on the surface, but underneath that is an energy that I am, you know, I believe kids read energy like Braille, and I'm reading the energy of, oh, my parents really show up when my teachers really show up when I am having any of those symptoms you mentioned. So so for that reason, my experience has been it's been very much the same. I've worked with a lot of suicidal kids and a lot of a lot of kids who were depressed, and you know, letting them know they're seen. I think we have a world of kids now who won't come out and play, who have the shades down, and they don't believe they're really seen for who they really are, and they don't know how to ask for what they need. And they, you know, they not only have the shades down, they have death grip on the shades, and they're not gonna let us in until mm-hmm. they really feel that somebody comes along and it's not talking them out of it. It's actually demonstrating. Here's the greatness I see in you. Here's mm-hmm. the wonderful qualities I see in you. Here are the wonderful mm-hmm. choices I see in you. And my experience has been that's when kids slowly let people in. And I was a kid who I maybe had two teachers who really engaged me as a youth. And even though I was really smart, I didn't care. I would get zeros in pretty much everything I could, except mm-hmm. those classes I couldn't help myself, and I was the best student in the class, and mm. and they didn't know what to make of me. You know, how could he be so, you know,
right?
So this way, you know, under one, you know, but they didn't really get what the pattern was, and these two teachers uniquely engaged me, and you know, under those circumstances, I just, you know, really got in gear. I didn't understand it either at the time.
But I remember growing up, and my favorite subjects, or the subjects that I was interested in and did well, were associated with the teachers that I liked. And you know, I completely hear you. And the subjects where I didn't have interest, or I was not, quote unquote, performing and getting the right grades and everything, were where, you know, there wasn't much of a rapport with this teacher. Mm-hmm. And adults have such a big role to play in making kids feel safe. And as you have so, you know, continuously pointed out, is to really let children open up. And as you say, let people in. You know, children do feel energy like Braille. I hear you on that. You know, it's very subtle, but it's very real at the same time. And it's so important to offer that. You know, I think that's the gift as adults we can offer to any child, you know, whether our own or, you know, nieces and nephews. It is so important to offer just that presence and trust, and so that the children let us in, mm-hmm. and then for them to discover, you know, they are great and they are the inner billionaires. Yes.
I hear how deeply you care. I hear the depths of your soul wanting children to know the beauty in them.
I think it's partly also what we've experienced in our childhood, and also mm-hmm. partly, you know, the work that we do with kids, and you can see the potential, and it's there, and it just needs to surface. So I'm so very thankful to have you, Howard, here with us, and sharing. How can we, as a community space, how can we help? How can we support you and your work?
Well, I really believe in a groundswell. I don't believe in I no longer believe in you know, trying to market this. You know, I believe that word gets out. I think if all we have at our disposal is normal, conventional, traditional approaches, and they're no longer a good fit for the kinds of kids we're getting, you know, ask any teacher, we're getting more of these intense kids. Mm. We're getting them at greater levels of intensity than ever before. So there's going to be more of a growing disparity between the methods we have and what we could accomplish by them. And the answer is not to keep pointing left and right at kids and saying you need an evaluation, you need medication. The answer is going to be people getting the adults, instead of blaming the children, realizing it's nobody's the fault. It's not the child or the parent or the teacher. It's the methods we have. And I think the way people, you know, I think, you know, when you say, what can we do to help, I just think, you know, if anything I've said today touches a chord, and anybody on this call decides to share, you know, that there's an alternative, you know, I'd like to believe that, you know, if they found their way to Nurtured Heart Approach, they'd see that despite the fluffy name, it's a very powerful approach design. You know, it was designed for these very challenging kids at all levels, and it happens coincidentally to turn out that it really ignites some greatness in every kid, or at least it appears that way. So, you know, that to me is the simplest way to help, is if you hear somebody who's suffering in relation to a child, a teacher, or a parent, and it sparks a thought to mention this, that's the best way to help.
No, definitely a groundswell is needed, and these conversations to amplify. And I don't think it's a fluffy name. It's a very, very authentic, approach. So thank you so much for being with us. I'm going to just let Seema step in, and she will be conducting a lot of the Q&A session from here on.
Thank you so much. What a beautiful conversation you sparked, and I really appreciate the background you've brought into the conversation and the research you did, so that so you were so knowledgeable already, and were able to bring up some really key aspects of this work. I really appreciate creating such a beautiful conversation.
Yes, truly, it's been a really lovely conversation, Howard and Nitika. Howard, the work you do is so inspiring, and we feel very grateful that you've shared it with us today, and I'm sure it's sparked a lot of thoughts and questions and experiences. So, Howard, I have a question of my own, actually. You were talking about your woodworking earlier, and you know, woodworking is such a craft, you know, of being able to carve and cut and manipulate this solid piece of material, you know, this beautiful piece of material that is wood. And I'm wondering, how have you been able to relate the insights that you learned from woodworking into the work that you do with children?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I have anything that comes to mind that I know to be a perfect fit. I think one thing I came to along the way was things have more substance when there's the structure of whatever you're building. Has a design that allows it to be strong, rather than compromising. So I think that structural piece has found its way into my work. Mm-hmm. You know, the work I do is predicated on three stands. You know, one is, here's what I'm not going to do. You know, if you've had a prior pattern with a child where they believe they get more out of life through negativity, you can't just say to a child, I'm not going to do that anymore. You have to show it to them. You have to live that. And so that's where that absolutely no comes in. The second stand is absolutely yes. Here's what I'm now going to do. In a prominent way, I am going to see the beauty in you, and I am going to express in words what I see. And then the third part, with, you know, any adult interacting with a child has to at times be faced with the prospect of limit setting. It's the way kids grow, and it's not a dirty word. It's just, you know, we all have limit setting in our lives. Rules help us organize our lives and feel safe. And you know, how does a parent reintegrate rules into a child's life so that the limits are clear and and where it's not coming down on them in a punitive, drastic way, but it's actually a light-handed way that engages the child to see their own power. I'll give you an example. I'm not a fan of video games. Maybe someday when they're uplifting and not insane and violent.
Right.
But if you watch kids play these games, the kids don't play to lose. They just play not only to win, but to go level of greatness, mastery and accomplishment. And I take that seriously. You know, these games have a structure that compels kids to successfulness. You know, while the child's, you know, going towards the goals and getting the goals, the game is pretty much confronting them energetically with successfulness. And at any given moment, the truth is the child can break a rule. And if they break a rule even a little bit, the game delivers. It doesn't say, Seema's having a bad day, let's let this one go, or she's having a good day, let's not break her momentum, or let's give her 10 warnings. You know, a toe on the line is a toe on the line. And we adults look at these limits and go, oh my God, they're drastic, you know, heads rolling and bombs bursting. But who's back in the game in 2 seconds? The child is. And even if the game's over, who's back in the game in 2 seconds? So the kind of illusion of a reset allows the child to get back. The game never holds resentment either. It always, you know, when the child comes back in, it's like full-fledged game in, game on. And they don't just come back in. They come back ever more determined not to break the rules and ever more determined to, you know, fly high. So I feel that the video game has all these components in the concert that it really creates a structure that is solid and in a lot of ways conflicts with the normal structure of a classroom or a home. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not, you know, how do we become clear with kids so they can have a clear life?
Right. It's kind of like putting creative constraints on children. And that's really when they're able to explore other areas within themselves that weren't, you know, that they couldn't reach before. You know, you have to put those guardrails on them in order for them to really, you know, achieve their potential. That's really,
I like that term,
really
guardrails.
So,
I agree.
So then, what are the levels of succeeding in terms of manifesting that inner wealth? You know, you talked about inner wealth before. So, you know, are there levels, a certain level that you want children to achieve, or is it just sort of case by case, or it's up to the individual child?
What an interesting question. I've never thought of it that way. I'd have to really, you know, consider. I did raise a daughter by way of this from day one, and she's now 25, and I never put it in that framework. I've watched her become a child who had, you know, like at age 12, I realized, well, she's so much smarter than me, and she's so much more tuned into her emotions, and she handles her emotions so much better than me. And, you know, I, as a parent, I realized, you know, what right do I have to tell her what to do. I just need to be here cheering her on appreciatively. And,
right.
You know, I've watched that continue to manifest. I probably in some framework of levels that I've never put, you know, thought into, where, you know, the friends she chose reflected mm-hmm. that wisdom mm-hmm. and the choices she made and the way she was a student and the way she has sought out friends and relationships. We were just in Australia, and she's learned this work. I mean, for better or worse, she's going to inherit the copyrights and the trademarks. So, you know, I wanted her to know the work. And she really came to it just incidentally because she was going to accompany me a few years ago to teach yoga at one of my trainings. And then she said, Dad, would you mind if I took the training? And she's just become masterful in it. And we went to Australia in February. And in the middle of that week, she said, Dad, I hope you don't mind. I've decided to stay. I want to live here for a while.
And, oh, wow.
But the way she did it was so sensitive and so thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And she had already looked into, how she wanted to do that. And she already had made an arrangement with some friends to at least stay there for a while to have a launching point. And that's what I mean by you could be just as out of control with a kid who's got inner wealth, because they're gonna act out greatness. And, you know, so I'm marveling at the fact that she's had this as a default, you know, steadily growing. So I don't know what the ceiling is on that. And I don't know what future levels that'll look like. But I'm in awe, and I just want to, one, stay out of the way, and two, applaud.
Yeah. You got to celebrate that. That's so true. You know, celebrate when any child is able to express that inner wealth in their own personal beautiful ways. So mm-hmm. That's really nice. So your daughter is one example, and she's grown up in this really nurturing environment with you as her father. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, you know, what about the kids, especially, you know, those that, that are bullies, and, you know, that don't necessarily feel that kindness either from their peers or their family or their teachers, and they lash out mm-hmm. by bullying others. Mm-hmm. So what's an example of maybe a child that you've worked with that you've seen their transformation, and what did that transformation look like, and how were they able to become, a kinder child as a result?
Well, thank you for addressing that incredibly important subject. I'd like to answer in a couple of different ways. When the congresswoman from my home state, Gabrielle Giffords, was shot, mm-hmm. I got to speak at a conference and related to that. And so I gave a lot of thought to bullying and, my being bullied, my subtle or not so subtle bullying as a kid. You know, I think we're all witness to this. We've all been bullied in some blatant and subtle forms. Maybe we've all bullied in blatant and subtle forms. Mm-hmm. I think it's part of our patterning. And one thing I found myself saying is I think bullying is not going to end until that inner conversation, until we're not bullying ourselves, you know, mm-hmm. where we don't thwart our greatness, where we don't thwart who we really are, where we really can be there in support. So now let me cut to I just this week I showed a film of a teacher who introduced Nurtured Heart Approach to her classroom. I believe they're 6th or 7th graders. And about 3 months into it, the kids asked, can we carve out 5 minutes in the morning every day where we take turns? A different kid is the recipient each morning of appreciation, accusations of greatness from the other students. And in this film, which I've watched a number of times now, what I see are 3 or 4 kids who are speaking in kindness and support, who look to me like they could very easily be taunting and teasing, tearing into the child. And kind of the word I'm playfully hanging out with for a while is rallying. I feel like these kids are, they're making these very interesting statements, courageous statements that rally behind the child instead of bullying. And to me, that's what I believe I'm going to contribute along the way and being able to show the world is that we could have whole schools where there's little or no bullying because kids come to believe in themselves, mm-hmm. because the adults in that school are leading the way and kind of passing the baton so they could see one another in that way. And you know, there are now a number of schools with low to no bullying where there's been no other initiative. There's been no, like, where it's not been about coming down hard or zero tolerance or any of these other, you know, programmatic ways of ending bullying. It comes from the inside out. Does that make any sense?
It does. And I think what's really key is that, you know, the adults kind of taking the lead in terms of being authentic and looking at their own behavior and how some of that behavior might be perpetuating these sort of bullying habits, so that these students have a role model to look to, you know, and to emulate. So I think that approach is really important and really authentic and a lot more effective. So thank you so much for sharing that.
I'm watching this very keenly. I'd love to be able to shout about it, and hopefully we'll get some research on that someday.
Yeah,
soon.
Please do let us know about that. Nepika, did you have any other questions you wanted to ask Howard?
Howard, I, you know, since I'm going to selfishly use this time to gain some learnings from you for my work, which is, you know, how do you design for compassion? You know, there's always, you know, one set that says it's innate, and it's but the conditions need to be for it to thrive. But how do you actively design for compassion, not only in a person, individually, but also in a system? So the example I have in mind is, you know, for a teacher, but also in a classroom as one system setting, and also a school, and then also as a set of schools in a state. There's something about really designing for compassion in a systemic way, which makes it safe for every child, you know, so they don't need to have these banners about, you know, zero tolerance or whatever, but it helps people really demonstrate that behavior, and therefore it is perfectly fine and okay and safe for the kids to manifest it themselves.
Yes, that's beautiful, and I may have one piece of the puzzle, which is, maybe I'll illustrate it through an example. There, where I live, there are quite a few programs designed to build character, and they may have, you know, 14 or 40 qualities of character, virtues and values, respect, compassion, wisdom, thoughtfulness, and these are beautiful characteristics. And the programs that I've, the character building programs I've seen have been more like the following, where, you know, a school counselor will mm-hmm. come in once a week by design, and they'll have their clipboard, and they'll talk to the mm-hmm. kids about the beauty of respectfulness, and it, you know, to me that's beautiful, and it's theoretical and philosophical until it's mm-hmm. real. Mm-hmm. I think it'll reach the easy kids, and it will the more challenging kids. It will still be impervious to the message we're trying to convey. In contrast, what I'm doing is immersing kids in being the quality, so that, you know, we're showing them, and it's not a question of whether you can or can't be this quality. You are this quality. So what I would do by design is create situations where that allow me to, for lack of a better word, accuse a child. Mm-hmm. Here you are right now being compassionate. And I mm-hmm. might have mm-hmm. 40 ways of being compassionate at the end of the mm-hmm. day. And every now and then I'll come back and point to child A, B, C, and D. Here you are being this unique, you know, strand of compassion. And, you know, compassion might be, you know, the thoughtfulness and wisdom in choosing not to break the rules. Here are some rules you're not breaking. It might be inherent in respectfulness and thoughtfulness and being considerate and making good choices and being discerning, you know. So, you know, for me, the design would be tweezing out all these delicious aspects of compassion that kind of reside in maybe subtle ways, but importantly in having a whole array of ways to express that to kids. And at some point, I don't think a seed sprout in a day, you know, mm-hmm. They you know, but when they, as they show up, you know, it allows us to point even more significantly, and it allows the child at some point to go, oh, I am compassionate. Oh, you know, so they get that I am rising up. Maybe that's what Seema said a little while ago in levels. You know, I think the levels I've experienced in myself, the levels of I am, oh, I am this kind of greatness. Oh, I am. You know, it helps people to claim it in better ways. I've noticed the better I claim it, the more I'm able to generate it and ripple it out into the world.
Yeah, well, yeah, lots of insights from there. I'm thinking, yes, there are definitely 40 and 40,000 and so many different ways of, you know, what compassion is and how that manifests and the situations to make that happen. And also your point about I am, you know, I am this already. I am. And I'm thinking how much of, you know, somatic work goes into to what your the nurtured heart approach. I'm sure there is that. But personally, what I've gained from, you know, somatic leadership work has really allowed me to work through certain, you know, conflict situations through that I am space.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole somatic, you know, beingness, you know, that mm-hmm. I am is so, so very powerful.
You know, maybe I don't know, you know, I don't want to sound flaky, but, you know, in some ways I am, so I'll own that, greatness. You know, I think on a soul level, we've all signed up for greatness. I think the atrocity is that on a planet of 7 billion people, 200,000 or more on the average die each day. And sometimes the first time anybody hears about greatness is at their memorial service. When it's so common for people, you know, hopefully they could hear it then, but so few people hear it while they're standing. And I think, you know, my hunch is that, you know, to get here and get a body, get the privilege of having a human body, you know, we've had to, you know, vie, you know, for that honor. And we had to, you know, promise up and down, yeah, I won't forget this time. I'm going to not only be my greatness, I'm not only going to remember it, I'm going to live my greatness. And maybe the final step to getting granted the privilege is, this is just me playfully saying all this, is, you know, we have to prove we're going to remember, you know, really. So, yeah, but, you know, what are you going to do? How are you going to prove that to us? Well, I'll give myself parents who tell me otherwise, and I'll put myself in circumstances where everybody tells me you're not great, but then I'm still going to remember how great I am. And then we get to planet Earth, and we experience the gravity, and we forget. I think the majority of people forget. We get pulled into the atmospheric energies of, you know, we're so great at seeing what's wrong. You know, we all have ancestry that once upon a time had to survive through thick and thin predators, and we had to be great at seeing tiny slivers of what's wrong. And, you know, it's in our DNA, so we could wax poetically about what's wrong, and we're not quite the poets about what's right. And I think that's part of the next hurrah for humanity is getting great at you know, being in our hearts and seeing with our hearts and hearing with our hearts and giving words to, you know, what our heart has to say.
I love this notion of being poets of you know, expressing the greatness in our own hearts. That's so beautiful and so eloquently put. We have a question from the community. So, hi, Howard. I joined this call because once a week I go to a juvenile detention center here in Boulder, Colorado, and I do a little bit of yoga and try to teach a little bit of meditation as well with that. And I've been on this call, you know, just wondering what is my question. And I realize my question is that I only see this, you know, a particular group of kids once a week. So when I return the next week, that same group of kids is not there. It's just, it's a new group each time. And I've been wondering, like, how to make the most use of the 1 hour that I have with them. I just have 1 hour each week with a new group of kids. Oftentimes, you know, I really don't even get a sense of who they are until I've been there for at least 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, like, if you have any suggestions for how to use what you've learned, into a situation like this. Do you have any tips for me, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, first of all, that's beautiful. It's beautiful that you do that, and it's beautiful that you care so immensely to reach them, even in that really demanding circumstance of having just access one time. So, you know, maybe I could give you an example. So I only know you for 30 seconds so far by way of your question, but I believe if we listen with our heart, we can hear, some threads of truth that give us a foothold and a handhold, and it might be parallel to the kinds of things you might say to them. So I, as I mentioned already, I could tell from your question how you're striving to find solutions, how you want so much to reach these kids, where even though it's only a one-shot thing, you somehow believe, or you're sparked to believe that, you know, maybe some good can come out of even that incidental encounter. So you know, if I had a lead-in like that to you, and let's say you were the one of the kids in the juvenile detention center, then I might say, and here's what that says about you. It says that you profoundly care, and you're somebody who's very determined. That's a beautiful quality. You ask so kindly and respectfully. You know, and one barometer to help this along is, you know, how not great could be. So how not great would it be if you didn't ask kindly? How not great would it be if you weren't determined, if you didn't care so deeply? So therefore, how great is it that you do, that you are respectful? So I feel like, you know, I've been doing this a few years, and it kind of flows for me. But along those lines, even in these very brief encounters of perhaps just minutes, you can see, you could speak to kids about their greatness, about qualities that are really just, it's almost like ripe fruit on a tree that's staring you in the face. And, you know, because we don't ordinarily talk to kids this way, we walk right by the, you know, the bounty. And all I'm saying is, here are some ways of tapping in. Does that make any sense at all?
I think so. I think you just done. I think what you're saying is that what you've just done with me, that in my 30 seconds of speaking, what you reflected back is something that I can offer. I think that's what you're saying.
Excuse me, and if I'm right about that, it's exactly what I'm saying. Thank you for listening so carefully and hearing me, and I appreciate that. And if I'm right about that, then I feel like some of those things will touch a child. And, you know, excuse me, maybe I could put it this way. I remember once upon a time there was a short section of the newspaper where I live in Tucson, and it had the lives of, it was kind of a pull-out section of a Sunday magazine, and it had stories about a dozen kids who turned themselves around, who had really tough lives, gang kids and other kids like that. And every single person, every single one of those stories, just short one-page stories, made mention of somebody who really cared, or one adult who made a difference. And sometimes they were very incidental people. So I would implore you to not discount one session. I would implore you to consider that you could be that person who just sees a kid and calls them out in their greatness, and that they might be sparked by you, and you might indeed be that one person who makes a difference.
Mm. Yeah,
you have a very soulful voice, and I could absolutely imagine you saying something that that just reaches a child in some profound way.
Well, and yeah, that's interesting, because now that I think about it, I'm like, wow, I've been in some of these sessions where I have seen like a really bright smile in one of the boys, or, you know, just a really generous nature, and I haven't said you know, I haven't really commented on that. I've just kept it to myself. So, So I think what you're offering here is that maybe we don't have to keep those things to ourselves.
I hope you decide not to, because you have a very fine command of language. You've already used a whole array of very special words, and you have a special resonance I hear in your voice. And I have no doubt that if you share away your perceptions and your sparks of what you see, the beauty you see in these children, that they'll respond to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not have to have the luxury of 10 consecutive sessions. Maybe it's really just that one-shot deal that'll make their life different.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate
it. You're so welcome. I'm so glad you called.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Howard, we have one comment that came through our web form from Kathy. She says, I was a more stressed out mom with my older daughter, who's now 8, and I see how that's affected her sense of security compared to my 4-year-old. Do you have any suggestions for bolstering her trust in the world?
I could make some. I am a fan of using the formatting of this approach. You know, my belief is that if as a parent, this mom can maybe read a little of the literature on the approach and come to see the beauty of the these three stands, so to speak. You know, being clear that she doesn't want to get inveigled in things where the child could be perceiving that she gets a mom through negativity, and if she makes it her mission to take that second stand, you know, I'm going to see my daughter in all these varied ways when she's doing the right thing, and in additionally, when she's not doing the wrong things. And, you know, in addition, have whatever normal limits and this very simple, clear way of providing a limit, but with the, just like in the video game, with the sense of let's have this consequence be over very quickly, and then right back on the heels of that saying, now you're not, your reset is over, and now you're not arguing, or now you're not fussing, or whatever it is that, you know, is of concern. You know, my belief is that the overarching energy of the child's sense of the world begins to change, and they start to believe they don't have to go to the trouble of having these issues to best have connection and relationships. Somewhere in there is a belief. Chances are a belief that the child's acquired through no fault of our own. We're just trying as hard as we can as parents to do the right thing. And if all you have is normal approaches, a kid can just simply inherit a sense to get more connectedness, a better broadband. You know how we don't want to go back to dial-up? You know?
we
want more bandwidth, better broadband. You know, kids want better broadband of us. Mm. We're the prize. They want
that's
us.
Great.
And I think that's kind of the healing edge for me is we show them, we demonstrate that the old way isn't available anymore, and the new way is they get this great connectivity to us through all the wonderful choices they're making, and then the issues you know, whatever they are, seem to melt away, and the child comes out to play, you know, in a much better way. It's kind of an overarching thing. I'm not after one symptom or another. That might be the starting point, that this mom's concern is what brings her to wanting to find something. Mm-hmm. And so if what I'm saying resonates, I would implore you to take on the bigger journey of applying the approach.
That's wonderful. Really, really wonderful advice that I'm sure will resonate not only with Kathy, but with others on the call. So, Howard, thank you so much.
You're welcome so much.
For sharing your wisdom today, you know, from telling us about the Nurture Heart approach, sharing about how all kids can be inner billionaires, and how we all need to recognize our inner greatness and speak the poetry of that inner greatness. And then this great thought you just shared with us of having better broadband, you know, that we all need access to each other's better broadband. So thank you so much. And thank you, Nithika,
so
for sharing such a wonderful conversation. At the count of three, everyone, please say out loud, thank you, Howard Glasser. So one, two, three. Thank you,
Howard.
You're so welcome. Thank you. That was beautiful. Yay. You made my day.
Well, you certainly made ours as well.
Our day.
So thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.